address it in the best possible way, but knowing, of course, that we are huge challenges. We don't have one issue, we have quite a few. Different currencies come into play, different personnel from time to time. Somebody has to play, somebody else has to come in there, and so these are intractable issues. Of course, we mustn't lose sight of the sense that within our modernization scheme, one of the big advantages of that would be that we would be on a digitized process. In other words, we stop accepting cash, which is going to place us, you know, completely on a different level in a few years' time, and we really urge that any support that you can give to accelerate our modernization plan would be very, very appreciated. Insofar as the financial management is concerned, of course, you all know that we've been fairly unstable in regards to the senior management of our units. We've had in September 2013 the resignation of our CFO, Mr. Rusani Razitinya. Minister Pando then appointed some person, Mr. Philip Bernardi, as the acting CFO for a period of time, after which he had to leave the department due in no small measure to his health. And it is only on the 1st of September this year that Mr. Hollenby joined us as a firm. And then the DG had to act in that capacity for a while, and then Mr. Hollenby has now joined us, and I must say this is going to provide us a huge stability in that unit and certainly puts us in a good position to address a lot of the challenges that face us. There were general comments related to accountability, and I think the DG will speak very specifically to the issue of accountability. But to reiterate what Mr. Hussein observed from the perspective of the minister, this is a very, very high priority for us, the issue of accountability, not just in terms of financial management, but also in terms of performance. Because you can't then focus on the one because the other then suffers and so on. So we, in fact, this weekend have a breakaway session with all of our top senior managers to address particularly this issue of professionalizing our department. Professionalism must be the one criteria that is imbibed by everybody, whether it's somebody who comes to clean the office, or somebody who's behind the desk serving a client, or somebody in the back office who performs back office functions. And this is really our objective in terms of the broader transformation of home affairs. I think the other issue that I just wanted to respond to was the issue of the target setting. Mr. Hussein painted a very colorful picture of his teenage love life when he alluded to but I think the real problem is, you will notice in the annual report that one of the things that we did embark on, and in fact it's, if it's not the Auditor General's report, it's the Audit Committee report, where we actually set and tweaked some of these targets. Because we thought that the targets themselves were a bit misplaced. You know, we come from an era where everything is about speed, everything is about efficiency. Because we've had such a bad experience of the Department of Home Affairs taking, you know, 300 days to issue an ID book in the past and so on. But actually, we have to balance those efficiencies with our security needs as a country as well. And the real question that we must pose is, are those targets realistic and are they relevant for our country? were able to tweak them in this period. We were not able to completely revise them. And so I do think that some of your concerns related to, well, you've only met, 53% of your targets, etc., is actually because I think some of those targets are completely unrealistic.
Do we, in fact, want to up our game in terms of permanent residency, in terms of efficiency, or do we want to look at the quality of those decisions? Do we want to see that the people who are getting permanent residence in South Africa actually add value to our economy, to our community, to our society? Or are we just granting it as if, you know, we're churning out processes? And I think these are some of the questions that we have to seize ourselves with. And it's very, very difficult to do that midstream. So that question, I think, has to be posed, and I think we have to be fairly realistic, both in terms of the department, but also in terms of the portfolio committee, bearing in mind what it is that ultimately we're all here for, and we're here to serve the people of South Africa, and what is their interest. Is it in their interest that we set these targets in such a way that constantly just requires speed? Because the minute you send that message out to people who are rank and file officials, then the tendency is always to just, let's skip the step, it's not necessary. And the more you do that, the more, I think, blurred the levels of accountability become, and so on. So that is certainly something that Minister Pando, who was the minister during this reporting period, had in mind when we did that review. But as I said, Chair, we were only able to tweak some of those targets, and I do think the time has come for us to seriously look at revising some of those targets completely. Finally, let me just make a request to Mr. Hussain, who posed that specific question relating to the school. May I request that we take that matter offline? I do want to hear from Mr. Hussain the full detail and gamut of the difficulty. I don't think he had sufficient time to pose that question properly. And also, I got a snippet of a report from Mr. McKay, and I do think that it needs some discourse for us to properly handle that matter. So that's my request, and I will certainly make myself available directly after this committee meeting to engage Mr. Hussain on that matter. That's in order. I then want to hand over to DG, and DG will, I suppose, also point to some of the DDGs on specific issues. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. We'll try to run quickly because of the time I'm concerned. Chair, I think the point of the DM, I want to reiterate that to say, as management of the Department of Home Affairs, we want to see a department which is efficient, which is run effectively in all respects. That's what we're striving for. We might have challenges now, but those challenges, we don't think they're above our resolution. We still believe that we can do this. Hence, we understand the disappointment. The issue of how the department can ensure that the information is correct. Chair, that's why we, in our presentation, we said let's deal with things which are can be seen by the people. When we say that 70 offices which have been refurbished, that can be tested. When we say now there are smart cars which people there in the country, that can be tested. If we say people are getting SMSs when they apply, that can be tested. So, Chair, we are saying, yes, there might be issues in terms of how you record that, but what we are saying is that we are reporting what is happening on the ground. We are not here to give what we think. And then, Chair, the question of implementing one-stop border post is still in process. We've done it now at Libombo border post. Once that process is finalized completely, then it reported to the committee as well that the department is in the process of is taking the lead in the establishment of a border management agency. So all those things are still going in that process, but the target that by 2016 it will be ready. Chair, we have looked at the issue of the service delivery plan. We are looking at all those impacts. We present it, we report it to the minister's meeting in order to make sure that we are able to improve our service delivery. As we said, that is a main concern for us. Chair, yes, of course, for the holding people accountable, that's why we said now we've got disciplinary processes. Who are taking people if they're doing something wrong and all that. That's why it is in our report, even in this case. If that people have done things which are outside what they're supposed to be doing, who are dealing with that. For instance, now last week, we even get disciplinary hearing now for managers who did not declare their interest, with whether there are few, but we're dealing with them. So issue of accountability in the department, we really, really deal with it. Then let me come now to the issue of, yes, we are not happy that we have achieved 53% of the targets. We want to strive for 100% for us to get there. So that's why we are really putting processes to improve, to say, if now to say we're at 53%, we really want to strive for 100% next year. If we don't, we want to be able to have real reasons why that particular target could not be achieved. So we are monitoring this even on our quarterly reviews. The minister comes and the deputy minister, they do sit. We don't do quarterly reviews as management only. They sit there with us so that they make sure why this target is not achieved, what interventions we can put in place. Yes, the question of contingent liability, no. We are on a cash base. We don't take money for that. The budget has nothing which goes to the contingent liability. So the budget of the department is utilized as it is. Then in the event that you can lose that particular case, is then that treasure. We don't budget even from the treasury side. We don't budget for any lawsuit. But in the event that that case we can lose it, then that will go back to treasury. So our operations are not affected by the issue of contingent liability. But the issue for us is to make sure that we don't increase contingent liabilities. Those cases are the old cases which we have, and all that. We are making sure that we are not increasing that figure. Instead, we are decreasing it. But there's one amount there which is sitting, we've been trying, it's about 400 million of a person who we're not even sure whether they're still alive, who came to South Africa then, and then said that didn't get a permit, and then sued the department for about 400 million, but that 400 million is in dollars. So we have to always budget for that. But now to take it out, we need now to have a process which must go to court and all that. So out of that, that is the biggest amount which we have on that amount. Chair, the issue of equal descent, I think, as we said, people, they collude. This issue, that's why we're to go to discipline the people. The case was reported in a court process. In fact, this amount, the court grant us a right, that bank account to be frozen. So that bank account is frozen as we speak, because it was the issue of collusion between the people, which I'm saying in our system is the one who said they must be able to tell us immediately, like this case, that's how we're able to pick it up as early as possible to say, how was this person being paid this amount when we're checking? And we're able to run to the bank whilst the money, they were still there. But if our system failed us, by the time we go there, we found nothing. So that matter now is still in the court fighting for the money which is in the bank account and deal with the issue. But the people who were involved on that matter were properly disciplined, but the matter is still in the court. That's that the issue of hallmark is a matter of FIUs, not it was it's a public way. So remember that as departments, we don't go and procure properties ourselves. So even hallmark is not something which was procured by us. It was procured by public works, so it is being dealt with by SIU through that process of public works, but not with the officials of the people. We didn't sign as Home Affairs procured the lease and all that. So it's a public works issue, but it's just that that building was listed under that. The register, we have a proper asset register. We've got a system which we are using. Now, our register is no longer on the Excel and all that. We've got a system called BOD, which we are using scanners and all that. So that asset register is in the system. It's not a paper asset register. But now the issue is to make sure now that it is cleaned, it is meeting all those requirements I'm talking about. So the department does have the asset register. Then I think as you said that in this issue of people being declared and we need to engage, I think ourselves would be available for that so that we can explain what are the issues and why we do it like that. Then another issue was on the training. I'm sure why the honorable member is raising this is to say the target was 600, but we have trained 667. No, remember we had that target, and then now we get stuff, but when we feel that there is still a gap, then we just add that, but within the budget which we have, we did not spend more money based on that. And then on the question on page 53, the draft policy and the legal framework document submitted for approval by DHA, CASTA and CAPA. What this paper we're talking about here, which we want to deal with it, is a fundamental question which we are asking ourselves as a department, which we also wanted to be understood clearly, that a Department of Home Affairs should be part of the security architecture of the country. But by saying that, we're not saying we must securitize Home Affairs. But if that identity document is acquired fraudulently, the impact of it in the security of the country is just enormous. So, and Home Affairs before was part of a GNA cluster, but there was a realization that Home Affairs must move to the JCPS cluster because of that reason. But to do that, we need now to look at, is there any legal framework which we need in order to make sure that we can be able to deliver our services in a secured manner. So that's why he has to go now to the cluster, go to the cabinet and all that. So that's what this target meant about. The other one is the issue of the case management system. So, which is that 3.212. That system, we were thinking to develop this system, but we had to follow a tender process, but at the same time, not leave it out now of our modernization process. So that now we've got another system which is standing alone, which is not interface with your other systems. But at the end, we're going to be creating again the silo approach of our system. So that's what we meant about that. I think that is a good question to say. Do we have drastic measures about this thing of training and what we want to do? Yes, there's a proposal which we are still doing in the department, which we just think it looks like it's a small issue, but it's a big issue. You know, in Home Affairs, that's really we are concentrating on service delivery. There is not even a minute of our staff to meet together and say, how are we going to approach the work of tomorrow? What am I must be doing at the back office and all that? We open our office at the time that everybody must be there. We don't do what banks they do. If you go to a bank, I think it's a Wednesday, the bank does not open at 8 o'clock on a Wednesday. They open at 9. What are they doing with that hour? Is to say now to your staff in the offices, check whether your register is right. Do this, do this, do this. And then once we have that hour, even for training, in fact, where we get frustrated as management, if I come, I visit an office, I can't talk to the staff of Home Affairs and say, this is where we want to go because I must serve these people. But if we can get that 1 hour, I will know that if I visit offices in the Eastern Cape, if it's a Wednesday, I must be there by 8 o'clock. I will find them there, and they will all in one room and say, where is your leave register? Why are you not doing this? You must understand this. So we are also looking at that. There is another responsibility that has been given to the deputy minister, which I'm sure at the right time, we will also, I think even during the budget speech, to say we wanted a program, which we call it Office Improvement Program, whereby now we must be able to say, how do we make sure that now our office is balanced? Because if we don't balance, we only look one side, which is the service delivery. We're going to be haunted by this. In fact, one manager said to us, look, I'm an office manager of this office, but I don't have a back office. I must run in the front. I must make sure that everything, I don't even have time to say, did I get all my receipts? Because I don't have one person. There is not a single person in an office who is responsible for finance. All of them are front office clerk, they deal with the service delivery. So we need to change that and say, it does not help us now. That's why we are saying it is so painful to us that we are pushing the target, but now we're sitting with this heavy black spot which comes over. But now can I own this 9,677? You've been saying to managers, we must convert.
We must get to a level now to say, you get 5 office clerks.
Take one and get a bag. Because if you don't balance the two, you can achieve this, but the other, you are not. So that's why now as a department we are looking to see whether we can get that balance. So that now these issues of audit evidence we're talking about, that in Home Affairs, as long we move out of paper, in the smart card, I don't have a problem with the evidence I will have because all that is automated. But if people still write a receipt, fill a form, inspect there and how to get, then we'll have such we are, say we are in that path, we'll be able to deal with that issue going forward. I think the issue of the Lindela has already been responded to. And with this issue, as we said, that a minister at a ministerial level, there are clear agreements which have been given as commitments how to deal with this matter of the disclaimer. We are having at our management level how we're going to be cleaning those. And will be able to support and the practical things which we want to put in place. And yes, as I'm saying now already, we have all the money we have, we are appointing about 200 interns, which must come in the department and be able to go and assist us. We've issued the order now to buy scanners, which is about 3 million rand. So now people go in the offices. And in a district municipality, you find that there's one scanner. And then I said, no, let's come up with a particular number so that we are able to verify your assets. So the plans which we have are supported with the resources which we do not have. Yesterday, we were sitting there and say, guys, I remember one of the things which you are cutting is when again one day bite us, but we don't have a way. We found that we've got money which we're earmarking to buy for furniture. I know our offices, not all have got furniture, but that is no longer my priority now. My priority now is to divert those resources and deal with these issues because we're putting them on the scale. And say, is it better to buy more furniture, or it's better for me to get in tens and the scanners and solve the issue of a disclaimer which we have. So those are the hard choices which we are taking in order to make sure that we support this program. Chair, if there is anything I've left out, then the colleagues can add. But I try most of the time, I try to run all of the questions.
Well, I'm sure you're still going to have us for the next 4 years. And, yes. so all what I'm saying is that we also invited IEC and GPW, and we can't afford not to ask them to entertain us this time around. We can't afford, and it's not the last day today. I think we're still going to have this engagement, especially with, I think the next one that's coming may be a quarterly report, and then which I think we can track certain things in the honorable members. Can I be assisted so that we move to IEC? Okay. Thank you very much. I think we need to thank the DG and the Deputy Minister for having led the team that empowered them to be able to respond to some of the questions and having spoken to us. I'm sure we'll be able to draft our report that needs to go to the House. And also, of course, saying take those unpopular decisions to make sure that some of the problems that we are having then get sorted out and then they get into history. And of course, is that we are here to assist you ever we have to assist, and we will after we have checked with the Human Rights Commission, I think we need to check their availability, and then we have identified a date, and if they are available in 2 weeks time, then we may be inviting you to come and hear them in front of us so that we come and do an objective discussion with both of you. Again, thank you very much, and I'm sure you are at liberty to listen to what IEC is saying within the family of Home Affairs. Thank you very much, Deputy Minister DG, and the rest of the delegation. Let me then invite the IEC possibly led by the Vice Chairperson, Mr. Thierry Tselane, and there is a Commissioner, Ranette Staliard, and then the Chief Electoral Officer, Mosotu Mayepsha. Then we have the Deputy CEO on Corporate Services, Ms. Fiona, I can't pronounce this surname, it's too long. Rowley Witt, you will assist us when you come in. And then and Mr. Stephen Langstrom is the manager in the CEO's office. And then can I ask the deputy chair to actually take us through whatever we have come across before, especially like the preambles, then you may just fly over and get to real issues so that the time is in your hands. If you need us to be here until in the night, you can just take us through, of course, after you have agreed with GPW. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members. It's always a great honor and a privilege to appear before this committee. I will start off by introducing the delegation from the Commission. My name is Thierry Tselane. I'm the Vice Chairperson of the Commission. And next to me is Commissioner Talzat, who is a member of the Commission. And behind me is the Chief Electoral Officer, Mr. Mosotu Mayepsha. And next to Mr. Mwebda is our Deputy Chief Electoral Officer, Ms. Fiona Rowley-Withy. And as you indicated, we also have on the other side there Stephen Langtry, who is a manager in the office of the SCU. I want to apologize for Commissioner Finger, who could not join us. He is in Mozambique together with another delegation that is helping with the elections in Mozambique. And Judge Makanya, who is also the fourth commissioner, was unable to come because his full-time responsibilities required him to be in court today. The report that we're going to be presenting today is a product of collective effort of the CEO, the commissioners, the deputy CEOs, the head of the staff, provincial electoral office staff, MEO staff, and the 218,000 staff members that we had. The reason why I'm mentioning this is because we developed this annual plan during the process when we were running the elections. And therefore, each and every person who we had during that period had a responsibility to make sure that our systems are not tampered with and are not compromised. And therefore, it enabled us to come up with the kind of the report that we have. And we're very excited that we are presenting a very clean audit. In 2010, when we appeared before the committee, we are extremely embarrassed because for the first time in the history of our organization, we had the qualification. But fortunately, we've been able to deal with those issues, and we no longer have the kind of the problems that we have. I think we've got systems in place, we've got the commitment, and we'll keep on trying to make sure that we receive a clean report, but at the same time be able to deliver on the mandate of our organization. Earlier on, when the committee researcher was making a presentation, he asked a question. He asked a few questions that he wanted the Electoral Commission to respond to. And in order for me to put into context the presentation that we're going to receive, I'm going to answer one question because I believe that that question is important in terms of putting into context the presentation. The question was, why or where does the Electoral Commission derive its mandate from in terms of delivering elections for all other institutions, because it appears that it is not there in the legislation. Now, if you look at the Chapter 9 of the Constitution, particularly Section 190, Subsection 1, it outlines the responsibility of the Commission. And these issues relate to the three most important, which is the management of the elections of the three spheres of government, the second one being ensuring that those elections are free and fair, and the third one is declaring the results there. Now, there is an important section. It's subsection 2 of the same section, section 190. And it says, the Electoral Commission has additional powers and functions prescribed by national legislation. Now, that national legislation is the Electoral Commission Act. It will cover the responsibilities, powers, and functions which are not necessarily contained within the Constitution. Now, if you go to Chapter 2, Section 4, this deals with the objects of the Commission. It says one of the responsibilities is to strengthen constitutional democracy and promote democratic electoral processes. Again, if we go to Section 5, Subsection 1D, it refers to promotion of knowledge of sound democratic electoral processes. And Section 5, Subsection 1K, talks about promotion of voter education. And Section 5, Subsection 2D, says the commission generally performs any act that is necessary for conducive to the achievement of its objectives. Now, I'm raising these issues because these issues begin to locate all those other responsibilities, because those responsibilities are located within the other functions that I've mentioned, particularly the matter of having to strengthen electoral democracy. So we're using various strategies of the Commission in order to be able to strengthen electoral democracy. Sometimes it means having to enter into discussions with certain institutions, assist them in running their elections as part of that responsibility. So the function of the Commission must always be seen within the context that I have outlined. Now that I have responded to that question, I'm going to request the Chief Electoral Officer to deal with now the details of the report, and then all of us who are here will be able to engage with you on all the issues that we'd like to raise. Thank you.
Honorable Chairperson, distinguished members, the Office of the Auditor General, and members and guests in the House, good afternoon. I've heard you, Honorable Chairperson, and I will go straight to slide number 4, because that slide deals with the strategic-oriented goals of the Electoral Commission, which we will talk about. There are 5 of them. The first one is achieving preeminence in the area of managing elections and referenda. The second one is strengthening electoral democracy. The third one is strengthening a cooperative relationship with political parties. The fourth one is to strengthen institutional excellence and professionalism at all levels of the organization. And the last one is to strengthen institutional governance. The researcher did earlier on look at the audit of performance-oriented outcomes for each one of those areas, and I will deal with them in detail. I have spoken to the researcher. There are 50 in total of those outcomes. We have achieved 41 of the 50 and not 36. I think there was a slight error in the presentation there, and I have resolved that with the researcher. Having corrected that, I'll go straight to slide number 18. The other slides, Chairperson and members, really relate to the functions of the Commission, the values. These are matters that I had the Chairperson say we have dealt with them extensively in the past. If one looks at the Electoral Commission, one would notice that you have the Commission being the 5 members, the Chief Electoral Officer reporting through the Commission, and having 3 deputy chief electoral officers, one each in the area of corporate services, and my colleague, Ms. Raleigh Withy, is with us today. The second one is deputy chief electoral officer in outreach. The third one is in the area of electoral operations. And their scope of work is defined underneath them in the diagram. But you also have support functions, one for commission services, which is an office that looks to the needs of members of the commission. We have 9 provincial electoral officers, one each per province. We have the internal audit unit headed by the chief audit executive and the office of the CEO in which Mr. Langtry is located. Without haste, I move to the number of goals that we had set, the performance-oriented goals that we had set. This I had identified, Chairperson, there are 50 of them, and 41 of those we achieved. Let me deal swiftly with those where we did not achieve or we exceeded targets and say why it was so or wasn't so. The first one is ensuring accessibility and suitability of voting facilities and processes by establishing and applying infrastructure to meet operational demands of every electoral event that we have. In that area, there are three performance indicators that we have put down. The first one is the number of contracted voting stations, because for every election, we must have this. We indicated that we were planning on 22,000 of this. You will recall that leading to elections, we followed settlement patterns across the nation, and that led to 22,263, and we have overachieved in that area. But it is important to look at the causes. We are finding that settlement patterns are developing at a very fast rate. The second one is number of schools that we use as voting stations, and this is an important indicator for ourselves and Treasury. It is proven that where we use schools, infrastructure in those schools does improve, because election after election, there are needs that we have, and these needs lead to improvements in infrastructure. We have exceeded that. We have planned for 66%. Sorry, we underachieved by 1%. Sorry, I said we overachieved. We were looking at 66%. We have achieved 65%. And this, it's important to indicate that whenever infrastructure develops, it's not schools that develop first. In many instances, you find informal settlements and then schools come in later, and that's a significant development in that area. It is important to know that when we go out there later, there will probably be those facilities and we will use them. The third one is the number of permanent warehouses and facilities that we use at the national, provincial, and municipal level. And in that area, we have in fact achieved as we had planned. The second one is ensuring efficient electoral processes by defining, specifying, and procuring election materials for all electoral events. And in that area, as chairperson and members, I'm quite happy to indicate that we have achieved that target as well. The third one was increasing the voter participation in elections. This we have revised, and it's no longer applicable, and therefore you will see that it will not be counted in there. The fourth one is maximizing electoral justice for all stakeholders. This means that we need to ensure that elections are held in the time that they should be held, that every process in that electoral process is undertaken as we should, and that there are no comebacks in the elections that we run. We have in this instance an indicator that says if we don't achieve, we will have a number of elections set aside in a year that we are dealing with this plan. And so far, so good. No one election has been set aside.
Sorry, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Chairperson. Sorry for you to interrupt, Presenter. But I'm concerned about the funding. It is worse here on the slide. If you can increase from there, so that it is visible, because some of us don't see a word. Thank you, Chairperson.
We will. The presentation is available through you, Chairperson. We will give that. That will also, perhaps if it's necessary, have another one that has large font. The effect is just that it becomes smaller on the screen if you increase the font.
Okay, you programmed the slides to fit on the.
Yes. It,
oh, okay.
Yes. But
yeah, if you enlarge, then you're gonna see pieces.
Yeah, my colleague will do that. Thank you very much, Honourable Member. I then move to the first one under Program 1, which is enhancing the credibility of the voters' role. There the indicator is that the number of registered voters as at the end of the financial year must be a certain number, and on this occasion we had planned to have 24.175 million. We have overachieved in that we had 25.364 million. And the increase is really in three areas. The first one is the decrease in mortality rate. We have indicated to this committee before that our mortality rate on registered voters has in fact decreased. The second one is an increase in the publicity around elections. In this elections, publicity increased significantly. The third one is the high level of electoral contest that we had in the election, which ensured that voters are kept interested in the elections. We've also looked at the frequency per annum that the voter's roll is validated against the National Population Register. We have planned to do 12 validations at least per annum, which is once a month, and we are doing so. It is a process that is very well run. The sixth strategic objective under Program 1 is improving compliance with legal prescripts, and under this performance, under this objective, we have four performance indicators. The first one deals with the percentage of elections for which the voters' roll is certified. Every one of our elections, we will have the voters' roll certified, and that's what we do. That's why we have achieved, and there is no deviation. The second one deals with the average number of calendar days in which elections are conducted from the date of the vacancy. The law requires that we hold elections within 90 days of the vacancy arising, but because, you know, these elections arise any day of the week, we'll try and minimize that so that we can improve the representativity of office bearers for the electorate. And in that respect, we have managed to attain 77 days. This, in comparison to 2012-2013, was 67, and the 10 days were the number of challenges that we dealt with in the committee, amongst others, relating to cases in KwaZulu-Natal, a number of by-elections that have unfortunately increased the 67 to 77. We are confident that that process will continue to reduce. The third area is the average number of calendar days in which we replace proportional representation councillors. These are the TR councillors that we replace on a regular basis. The law gives us 35 days. We have done so in 16 days. And Chairperson, I need to indicate that this is an area where in local government, contestations are very high within parties, amongst parties, and in relation to the councillors, and there are a number of cases that affect this replacement as we speak. The fourth area is the average number of calendar days in which election results are declared or announced by the Electoral Commission. In that area, the law gives us 7 days. We do it immediately after an election, and therefore we take only 1 day. The seventh strategic sub-objective under this program one is continuously improving the legislative framework within which we operate. And in that area, one of the performance indicators we are looking at is the number of electoral legislation reviews that we undertake per annum. In this period, because of the elections, we had undertaken a review before the time. We did not have one that we needed to undertake in this period. We also needed to look at the number of relevant bills submitted to Parliament per annum. We had planned one, and we have attained that one. The third area is the number of regulations published in the Gazette in relation to the work that we do. We had planned to do one, but we published three. And these three really relate to the aspect of voter registration that we had dealt with in terms of the legislative revision as per the amendment bill, but also the regulations of registered voters outside of the Republic. The second one dealt with the sub-regulations for the submission of lists of candidates. There were a number of changes that we had indicated. We will deal with, we have successfully dealt with those. And the third one is dealing with election regulations. For all of the amendments that we had made or undertaken in the Electoral Act, we also had regulations which were affected that we had published. And therefore, in that area, we have done all of that work. I move to Program 2, Chairperson, and the first strategic objective there is encouraging citizen participation by providing continuous education. And in that respect, one of the indicators that we have is the number of civic and democracy education events that we hold per annum. The researcher quite correctly indicated that we have overachieved in that area, but there was a note that we have attached to this, which we have worked through with National Treasury and the Auditor General to look at defining the event. One of the things that the Auditor General spoke about on verifiable evidence was in this area. The challenge is simply this. When you go into a school and you do democracy or civic education, the biggest challenge you have is to say, if you meet 500 people, is to produce auditable evidence that every one of the 500 people would have signed the register for you, or you have taken a photograph and things like that, and also putting this into a system. Previously, we did not have an operational system that we put this into. And that really, you know, led to a situation where across the country, in 22,000 areas where you have a voting station, you would deal with this in desperate ways. We now have a system that we have implemented in this financial period, and it will deal with this area. But all in all, we have overachieved, and we will be stabilizing this area. The second one is providing strategic and thought leadership in electoral processes or the work that we undertake as the Electoral Commission to be at the forefront of the discourse in electoral democracy. In that respect, the performance indicator we had was the number of thought leadership initiatives that we had per annum. And thought leadership initiatives are really initiatives that we facilitate for public discourse to be had on issues that we deal with. And in that instance, we have said we will have 20 of them, and this was our first year of such initiatives. We, in fact, had 41 of those, and we overachieved by 21. The third area we have under the program two is broadening our research agenda, dealing with issues of public participation, publications, and preserving institutional memory. And in that instance, one of the key indicators is the number of research projects that we have conducted. We had planned to conduct three. We have, in fact, undertaken three of those research projects. Second one is finalizing and implementing knowledge management systems. I have spoken about this very briefly now. We had intended to implement in the previous financial period of 2013, 2014. We could not because of the elections. We are implementing as we speak, and the process is well underway. The fourth area under Program 2 is increasing institutional visibility through proactive consultation, effective communication, and presence. There we look at media opportunities and the number of interactions we have with the media per annum. I'm very pleased to indicate that we have indicated those numbers, the 30 media releases. We have landed on 47. We have intended to have 100 media interviews. We have achieved 420. We had intended to have 12 media analysis reports. Indeed, we have had 12 media analysis reports, one a month throughout. The second area that I look at is the number of targeted communication platforms per annum. We have looked at the number of platforms, chairperson and members. We had thought initially that we would have four of those, and we have achieved 14 of the platforms as listed we had planned 14, we have achieved 14, and therefore there is no deviation in that respect. The third area is the number of stakeholder relationships and engagements that we have established and maintained in this period. We had planned to have 150 stakeholders that we would keep throughout the period. We were overwhelmed in regards to this aspect because there were many stakeholders who, in fact, also came to us and said, we want to be part of this. And this being a good thing, of course, we took them on and had 22 more than we had planned to have. The fifth strategic objective under Program 2 is facilitating platforms for stakeholder dialogue. And the first indicator there is the number of meetings we had with stakeholders per annum. We had planned 46. We have achieved 44. And this, it's the two of the meetings were moved into the electoral period. Initially, when the plan was heard, the elections were going to happen in the financial period falling in the previous year, but they moved into the 2014-2015, and those two would be recorded in the period that we are now in. The sixth strategic objective under Program 2 is positioning the Electoral Commission as a continuously improving organization through ongoing interaction and liaison with relevant international stakeholders. Here we looked at the number of interactions or liaisons that we have internationally per annum. And many of this come through government initiatives and the Department of International Relations, amongst others. There we have planned 13, but 26 of this happened. We have had electoral commissions, particularly in North Africa, Libya, Egypt, those areas, spending quite some time with us. In fact, also electoral commissions from Palestine, and therefore the number has substantially increased. I now move to Program 3, which is political liaison. Here we are looking at deepening political engagement with represented political parties, including convening consultative forums with registered political parties. The first performance indicator that talks to the number of liaison sessions with members of political liaison committees. And in that respect, Chairperson, I regret to indicate that we have not achieved. One of the challenges that we had related to the holding of meetings, particularly at the municipal level, where we have had to experiment with changing dates on which meetings were held because of the non-availability of party representatives who indicated that some of the meetings were clashing with their municipal council roles and responsibilities. This is an area we are providing attention to, and we will deal with going into the future. The second area deals with funding of political parties on a quarterly basis, and we continue to maintain that. We have attained what we have planned to do. The third area is the number of training sessions conducted with political parties. There we indicate that every office at the national office would have one session, and each one of the provincial offices would also have a session. In reality, we had more sessions in some respects and less in others. And the Western Cape in particular, they became regionalized as opposed to provincial. But we attained, we achieved what we had set to achieve and exceeded that slightly more. I now move on to program four, which is corporate services, and the first strategic objective there was striving for excellence at voting station level. This talks to ensuring that the professionalism with which we run elections permeates to the lowest level of the organization, being there where we meet with voters. And the first indicator there was the number of electoral staff recruited and trained per annum. We had indicated that we would have 50,092 of the staff members. A number of interventions occurred. The first one related to streamlining operations, but also dealing with, to a degree, the issue of austerity in our environment. And in that respect, we have revised our plans after these plans were forwarded, and ended up with 46,261 staff members. Against the plan, it indicates an underachievement by 3,800, but if you look at an area immediately underneath that, you will see that we had increased the number of area managers to compensate for the reduction, and also to have a buffer capacity of 25% of those members that we had reduced at that level. This is an issue we will look at again, but it has worked for us in these elections. The second strategic objective under Program 4 is building institutional capacity, and in that respect, we look at the number of permanent staff positions that are filled per annum, and in this respect, I indicate to you, Chairperson, that we have created new posts and we have filled those posts. It does seem like we overachieved, but there were more posts created as well. We did achieve, but the additional posts also indicated that we had an overachievement. The second area under that second indicator under that strategic objective is the number of bursaries. They increased from 80 to 86. The third one is the number of international and external, internal and external short courses. We have placed a number of staff members on courses, and development has been a significant part of the work that we do. We overachieved in that area.
Third objective under program four,
we are looking at strengthening the presence and effectiveness of the Electoral Commission at local level, in the local sphere where we operate. And there we looked at the number of fixed-term staff that we appoint. Leading to an election, we have what we call an expansion staff program. We implemented that program very successfully. The overachievement talks to the hotspots that we shared with members of the committee in the previous term, because there were a number of hotspots in the country, and we dealt with them by looking at additional capacity and reserve capacity as may have been necessary. That has helped us a great deal. The fourth one is adhering to performance standards, and there we were looking at performance agreements for the year, and we attained that except for two cases really, where there were late appointments or persons appointed at the end of the period, and the one person who for disciplinary purposes was on suspension at that time. We also looked at the performance assessment for the previous year, and in that respect, we did as we had planned. The fifth strategic objective under Program 4 was becoming people-centered, and there we were looking at one national office and one provincial office, a wellness program in each one of those areas. We must indicate that we had planned 10. We only attained 7. And to a large extent, colleagues indicated that because of the electoral program, this would have been very difficult to attain in the period. We should learn from the process. The sixth strategic objective is managing financial and human resources well. And there the measure was meeting our statutory deadlines in respect of budgeting. We have attained what we had planned. The second indicator there was holding self-management accounts per annum, or having self-management accounts per annum prepared and submitted to the accounting officer. That was attained. The seventh strategic objective in Program 4, Chairperson and members, related to exercising oversight. In other words, monitoring, evaluation, and support by ensuring that this fairly, the financial statements are fairly presented. In that respect, we had indicated that we want to achieve an unqualified report, which we have achieved. Our report, as we will present later on, is unqualified indeed. The Vice Chairperson said, I think Vice Chairperson said, clean. It's unqualified, and I just thought, let me just correct that as well, Vice Chairperson. I like clean, but we work hard on that. Program 4, the strategic objective 8, strengthening risk management. This is an area that has been very tricky for us. It's been an area that we were developing. We have strengthened this area. We continue to strengthen it. It's not where it's supposed to be, but we are continuing to do work in this period, which we hope will, in fact, serve us and stand us in good stead. The second indicator there is quarterly review and update of the Electoral Commission Strategic Risk Register. That has happened as we had planned for it to happen. The ninth strategic objective in this area is maintaining sound industrial relations. We have planned in this period to have opened and reviewed the recognition agreement. I'm reporting to members that on account of election, the recognition agreement has in fact been attained shortly after the election period, which is in this period after the financial year end. The 10th area there is striving to comply with national climate change policies, and this is it's greening our environment and observing green policies. This is an area that's still under consideration, and we are going to be working fairly harder in this process now than we have in the previous period. It's an area where we did not attain as well. The 11th area is providing and maintaining adequate office infrastructure to enable a safe, secure, and functional working environment. And in that area, Chairperson, I must indicate that we have attained the first indicator, which is the number of facilities that were under contract that we needed to review. We have dealt with those successfully. Security contracts that we needed to look at, we've also dealt with those successfully. The number of vehicles that we needed to replace, you will notice that we had planned to have 20. We have dealt with 57. 37 of those are the ones that were supposed to have been replaced in the prior period that we kept because of the elections and have used in the in the period, but also we have disposed coming from the prior period in the financial statements. The fourth area or indicator there is the number of vehicles disposed per annum. I have indicated that those vehicles that had earmarked for disposal came into this period, and we have dealt with them accordingly. The 12th area, Chairperson, which is the last one, is providing and maintaining a stable, secure, and scalable information communications technology environment that meets the functional needs of the Electoral Commission. In this respect, we had planned to have a review of our infrastructure and environment. That review was undertaken, and the work was undertaken as we had planned. We also looked at the annual percentage of network and application systems availability. In other words, looking at downtime and how soon we recover. We wanted to be up 97% of the time. We were up almost 99% of the time. We attained 98.9% of that target. The last program that we look at is Program 5, which deals with the first one, which deals with governance and international dialogue within the Commission. The first strategic objective there, Chairperson, was refining institutional governance arrangements. And in that area, we have four indicators. I must indicate that two indicators were not achieved. The first one was the number of governance committee meetings that were held in the year. There are six governance committees. The plan was to have 12 meetings, one a month for each one of those. We indicated earlier on that we did find that the governance committee in particular did not need as many of those sessions as was necessary. But there were one or two other committees that did not meet for the 12 occasions that they needed to meet. The other area that we did not, we overachieved was number of of commission meetings that were held down. And the commission had planned to meet 11 times, they met 13 times. But this is in the period leading to elections, which is fairly understandable. The last but one strategic objective there under Program 5 is exercising oversight by members of the Commission and ensuring that we meet the plans and targets as we have. And the number of quarterly reports that were provided to members of the Commission were as planned, 4 out of 4. The number of annual reports were as planned, 1 per annum, and that's what has been done. I now come to the last strategic objective under governance and international liaison, and that deals with oversight, exercising oversight again with respect to providing assurance and value-adding oversight in this respect. There we looked at the number of risk-based annual internal audit plans. We had one, and we have worked in terms of that plan. And secondly, we looked at the number of quarterly internal audit processes. which we had four of them, one per quarter, and each one of those was achieved. Chairperson and members, and that is our report on the performance-oriented outcomes. I'd like to let the Deputy Chief Electoral Officer for Corporate Services, who was also in the period responsible for the financial statement as the CFO, to go through the financial statements for the year ended 31st March very briefly.
Thank you, CEO. Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. I will briefly touch on the financial status of the Electoral Commission for the year ended 31st of March 2014. To begin, I'll deal with the audit outcome, recognising, of course, that it was addressed by both the researcher and the Auditor General this morning. But we did, in fact, have an unqualified audit opinion. There were no emphasis of matter paragraphs in respect to the annual financial statements. There were no additional matter paragraphs. There were no findings on the usefulness of predetermined objective information. There was the one finding on the reliability of predetermined objective information, which was the one in relation to, as our CEO has recently indicated, the 65,000-odd electoral outreach events that were held, and that the outreach management system, the OMS as we call it, has been implemented now, which should address that going forward. There was also one correction to the annual financial statements. To put it in context, in terms of the apparent regression in terms of our audit outcome, it needs to be noted, I think, that the financial year was on the 31st of March 2014. The election was on the 7th of May. Our financial statements and annual report was due on the 31st of May. So to try and achieve the kind of outcomes we did in the previous year would have been a big ask. We did ask ourselves to do it. Unfortunately, there were errors that slipped through while we were all paying attention to holding the elections. In terms of the basis of preparation for the financial statements, it's broadly speaking the same as the previous year. We operate on the accruals basis of accounting, different from government departments, which means expenditure that is incurred but not yet paid in cash, we reflect in our expenditure. In traditional modified cash basis of accounting as applied by government departments, expenditure is only reflected when the cash leaves the bank. But our financial statements were prepared on that basis and have been for some years, and there were no changes in terms of our accounting policies. If we look at the statement of financial performance as of the 31st of March and the comparative, you'll see again here very clearly the difference in scale is reflected. In the year to 31st March 13, our revenue was 768 million and our spend 765 million. In the year that's under review in this annual report, our revenue was 1.4 billion, close on 1.5 billion, and our spend pretty much the same. You'll note the significant increases are in employee-related costs, which is detailed in Note 17 to the annual financial statements, and of course reflects that expansion capacity that was being referred to by the CEO, both in terms of our ops as well as the outreach capacity that we bring on in the short term. And then goods and services more than doubled from 325 million in the previous year to 740 million in the year under review. The details for that spend are contained in note 18 to the financial statements on page 141 of the annual report. And broadly speaking, key increases include things like communication and connectivity. We increased our bandwidth between the various local offices, national offices, and the provincial offices, as well as between the ROCs. So our spend on connectivity and telephones went up from 28.9 million to 42.6 million. Conferences and workshops, our spend doubled from 21 million to 41 million. broadly speaking, these kinds of conferences and workshops are training events both for our internal staff, our expansion staff, as well as, of course, for the 45,000 staff we employ for the two registration weekends. And in this year, we would still have started some of the training for the 214,000 people we employed for the period of May the 7th and the special votes immediately before. Electoral staff subsistence and travel. In 2013, we spent just shy of 6 million, 5.8 million in fact, and in the year under review, we spent 74.3 million. Again, this is in the 2013 year, there were no major electoral events at all. We did, however, as part of our process in trying to professionalize and improve the level of service delivered by our electoral staff at a voting station level, we have undergone a process of continuous contact with those presiding officers in particular, and the 6 million in the 2013 year that spend was in relation to that constant communication with the presiding officers. The 74.3 that we spent in the 2014 year would have been the spend on subsistence and travel, that's the stipend we pay to the registration officers, as they would be for the two registration weekends that would have been November 2013 and February 2014. Our professional services budget also increased significantly. Here, this is the line item where we include things like the communications campaigns, as well as the media buyer, and items like the enhancements in terms of electoral systems that are brought about as a result of changes in legislation or other business imperatives. Looking at the rest of the statement of financial performance, the depreciation number is relatively stable, reflecting our reasonably stable asset base. Audit fees are a million more, which is in the region of a 25% increase, which is not bad, given a double spend. The rest of the numbers are relatively small. Apart from repairs and maintenance, you'll notice a significant increase there. In the previous year, it was 9 million. In this year, it was 31 million. There are two key elements that make up that increase. The 9 million, in fact, is slightly higher than it was the previous year, but it was where we started the process of we identified a service provider to maintain our fleet of ziplets, obviously critical in advance of the registration weekends and the elections, and that process continued and reached completion before the election, so the bulk of that spend was in the 14 year. In addition, we replaced the internal and external batteries for that fleet of ziplets, and that spend, because there was no enhancement to the asset, it was merely a maintenance exercise. That spend is reflected there in the repairs and maintenance. If we look then at the statement of financial position, and first off the asset side of the balance sheet, essentially here you have a snapshot of an organization at the 31st of March 2013 that was 7 months ahead of a major electoral event, and at the 31st of March 2014 was about 5 weeks or so away from the most significant electoral event in our calendar. As a consequence, cash and cash equivalents was 80-odd million and is now, at the 31st of March this year, was 153 million. That's offset on the next page when we get to liabilities. You'll see there's a concomitant increase in current liabilities, reflecting the heightened activity, essentially, as the invoices, our spend dramatically peaks in the last sort of few months before an election and the first couple of months thereafter. Trade and other receivables, that 22 million is, broadly speaking, either deposits in respect of our, we've got approximately 270-odd local offices, 10 warehouses, nine provincial and one national, and then obviously nine provincial and one national warehouse office, and those deposits are reflected there, as well as anything that was necessary to be made to secure facilities in advance of the election. those are the rocks. Inventories, 43 million as against 11. Here again, it's the ramping up of activities in advance of the elections. Included in there would be all of the ballot boxes, the electoral security items, the t-shirts for election staff and so forth. I've indicated already that our asset base is relatively stable. Some small movements in relation to the normal asset replacement cycle, and the non-current assets held for sale and assets of disposal. The last round of review of obsolete and redundant assets having been completed, those assets were sold early in the financial year. The next round had not yet begun. Looking at the liabilities then, I did indicate that trade and other payables was the counterbalancing increase that was as a result of the cash because of the heightened activity period. We are reasonably successful in paying all of our bills within 30 days. There are a few that slip through, but broadly speaking, we're pretty much on track. This just reflects the absolute peak of activity at this time of year. Our provisions is relatively small, it's quota. The foreign and local aid assistance from the previous year relates to monies that we hold when we do elections for other bodies. We generally get monies in advance, and when we incur expenses, we write them off against those monies so we don't incur the costs ourselves. But obviously in an election year, we're concentrating on our own elections rather than those of other bodies. The operating lease liability there is the grant adjustments related to lease smoothing, it changes in relation to the number of years left on our lease agreement, and then the accumulated surplus, broadly speaking, reflects both the movements in working capital and the as-yet undepreciated portion of our asset base. And I'll pause there. Thank you.
Thank you, Shepherd. I think you by Shepherd as well. I'm sure we'll give you a question.
You are heavy.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson. That is a presentation from the Electoral Commission, and we are in your hands.
Thank you very much, and Honourable Members. We must just keep in our minds that we still have GPW. Can we then talk to the presentation of the IEC? I recognize Honorable Hussein, then Lisi, am I done, or Finland, in that order, can you see it, Honorable Hussein?
Yes, thank you very much. I don't have as many questions as I have than I did for the department, but nonetheless I'll raise it. When you think of an organization that can move some 289,000 people on one day in one direction and get the right outcome, then that's no mean feat. So perhaps maybe the DG might want to sit with the guys at IEC and try and figure out how do you move 10,000 people in one direction. I'm sure maybe there's some information there that will help. But that's on the sideline, and credit to the IEC for the work that they do in making South Africa proud in the international world and our ability to put together an election campaign. My question here is more policy matter, and possibly directed by the chairperson than the chief electoral officer, but whoever wants to take it. And the point is about free and fair elections and promoting an environment conducive to free and fair elections. I was interested to hear the comment that there is an increase in the amount of court challenges between political parties, and that one makes, you know, it makes one think that that's always an indicator of something. And the question I ask in my mind is that is our current legislation sufficient enough to be able to actually promote an environment that's free and fair? And I'm being very careful about the way I manage this question. I'm trying to avoid the political just, it can't be right that you only try to bring a free and fair election process. When I say process, I mean the day of the election itself. Surely the events leading up to the election contributes to a free and fair outcome. I give you one example. And I'll use the Western Cape government in this particular case. Assuming for a minute if the Western Cape government has to increase the amount of advertising in the months in the run-up to the election campaign, just assuming that that's the case, surely that must skew the result in favor of one political party or the other. Surely that must. Because it means that the playing fields are not level, and if the playing fields are not level, then you can't have a free and fair election. And so the question that I put is that, is our legislation sufficient at the moment? Because the indicator for me is there's court challenges, and that the more political parties fight amongst each other, it means that there might not be sufficient legislation in place to actually regulate the environment. Because often when you bring a matter to the IEC, they say go to the SAP. And then you go to the SAP, they say run to the IEC. So, you know, maybe there must be something else, another tool in place that will regulate the manner in which political parties conduct themselves between elections and not just during an election campaign. So I'm really interested to hear your view on whether or not that would be necessary in our current environment. Surely the democracy that we've worked so hard for and achieved so far, which is something that you want to actually make sure that there's sufficient legislation in place to protect it. I'm not sure so there is. Chair, the other point I want to talk about is the issue of voter registration. And I recognize that in this particular outcome that you've achieved, the IEC has achieved much more than what you set yourself out for in terms of actual figures of registration. But I wonder actually if more can be done, and I know that the figure has increased steadily over the years. And I always wondered why the IEC doesn't do more in terms of actual outreach of voter registration apart from just voter registration weekends. I think, for example, a person who walks into the bank is quite likely to have his ID document on him at the time and be able to register that person there and there because he's got the document to do it. The other one is that on an election day, I'm sure your experience would be that thousands of voters turn out who are not registered only to discover at the voting station that they're not registered. And so if they're there at that time, why not add a zip the machine and register them so that the next election day they'll be able to do it? Because in a number of instances, these people actually don't go out and register when they are voter registration weekends. I accept that the IEC does a fair amount of work to increase the figures, and the proof is there. But I'm interested to hear what your response is to actually trying to find some innovative ways of getting registration done. And on the point of registration, come to the point of fraud on registration, voter registration. Now, this is not anything new. You've heard about it before, the very famous Lotta case in KZN. And that's not new as well. I mean, that happens over and over and over again. Political parties complain about illegal registration, people registering at wrong addresses, or being manipulated by political parties to do that to skew the results in favor of one. And there must be warning signs for you when you see that in a particular address there are 15 people registered in a two-bedroom home, for example. Is there a mechanism in which you can find to try and reduce that? Because that speaks to free and fair elections as well. If a political party is able to manipulate the outcome using your own systems, then surely there can't be a free and fair election. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Of course, without underscoring your accolades, the DG is moving plus minus 53 million people every day, yeah? Okay. Honorable Liz.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you very much from the Commission. I understand, Chair, that our IEC has reverted back to an unqualified audit opinion after getting a clean audit report in 2013. I'm just saying that there is always a room for improvement. I also would like to commend the Commission for sticking to their constitutional mandate of promoting conducive conditions for which of the performance indicators in program 2 did the AG indicate that insufficient evidence was available? If I can get that clarity. My last question, Chair. It is clear that there is a bit of a challenge in the IT operation. What is being done to address the continued low capacity in the IT operation component? Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Fichler. Thank you very much, Chairperson. I'm just concerned about the issue of the legislation and amendment and regulations that I think almost will take about maybe a year or 2 years to do a legislation like that. But how did IEC able to finalize 3 sets of regulations within a year when it has planned for one? And then second question is, what type of work do the 7,015 semi-skilled casuals and fixed terms staff do in contrast to the 218,000 temporary person employed only for election day? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Maybe from my side, I think that there is, in your report you're talking about a post for the chief risk and legal compliance, which you are not saying that it is filled, you are still talking about it. And then if you could indicate, you know, it's, when are you going to finalize it, you know, it's so that whatever actions that you are taking as an institution, then you have gone through this risk assessment and probably legally advised, especially in relation to your current activity now of the lease agreement that you are debating about, so that you are properly advised, avoid unintended consequences of fruitless expenditures and the rest. If you can just finalize that specific one. And I'm not sure, because there was some time, I think, of an outcry of people that were crying about payments. I think it is in the period under review. And then what, how you have fared in dealing with that one. I think you can proceed.
Thank you very much, Chairperson and honorable members. Let me start with the first question relating to free and fair elections. Is the legislation sufficient to be able to deal with all aspects that would determine whether an election is free and fair? And whether the court cases are actually an indicator that there is a problem, sir. I think I would want to answer this question in two respects. The fact that we've got court challenges, in fact, it's not necessarily a bad thing, because courts, particularly the electoral court, is there to, as an instrument that assists in the electoral process. So if there are issues between the political parties and the issues that they want to raise, they should always be able to have an avenue that they can pursue those issues. And the electoral court specifically assists in terms of dealing with these issues. But the second issue, which I think is the more fundamental question that I detected from your question, I think to a large extent the legislation of each country is dependent on the specificities of that particular country. If, for instance, you take the case of India, on the day of the elections, almost all the state instruments are in the hands of the Electoral Commission. And therefore, you can't find, for instance, a minister launching a program during the week of the elections, etc., etc. Those are some of the things that are there in the legislation, and then the commission implements those kinds of things. Now, we recently had a meeting with the political parties, and the political parties raised this issue to say there are so many issues that are related to free and fair elections, and then they want the Electoral Commission to deal with. We indicated to the political parties some of the difficulties that we have. One of the difficulties is that some of the things that the political parties want are not in the legislation. They are not within the realm of the Commission. And therefore, if they want to pursue those issues and want to empower the Commission to deal with some of those issues, then the legislation would have to be changed, and changed in such a manner that the Commission is empowered to be able to deal with those kind of issues. Now, we have agreed with the political parties that we're going to be having a workshop where all these issues that the political parties have been raising are going to be dealt with. We're going to produce a discussion paper for all the political parties to be able to see and understand the environment within which they're operating, and also understand the respective roles and responsibilities of all other bodies in the electoral sphere. You know, so we are hopeful that that particular conference will be able to give us guidance in terms of the kind of the things that the political parties in general would like to see changing in the legislation in order to empower the Commission to deal with some of those issues. But just to caution the political parties, sometimes I get this impression that the political parties also want to use the notion of free and fair to pressurize the Commission to take one position or the other in order to campaign or decampaign each other. Now, it would be a very dangerous thing if the Electoral Commission is forced into a situation where it campaigns and decampaigns the political parties. We've got to be given space of the Electoral Commission to be able to perform that responsibility of running the elections without having to be embroiled in the teeth that the political parties normally get involved in when they are dealing with the campaign. Commissioner Tazer would like to add on to that particular issue, and then I can deal with one other issue and other issues Commissioner, the Chief Electoral Officer, will deal with.
Thank you, Vice Chair. I just want to very strongly endorse the comments by the Vice Chair, but I think there are two other issues that arise that are quite important. The first is the issue of also looking deeper into the constitutional hierarchy and the constitutional codependencies that exist, because what I often see is an expectation on the part of the political parties that the IEC will step into terrain that is effectively, easily, and constitutionally the terrain of other entities. And I'm highlighting it not because it's necessarily the most comfortable solution for a deeper look at free and fair, but I'm highlighting it because it's a very clear reality. There are codependencies with ICASA. There are codependencies with the Municipal Demarcation Board. There are clear areas when if you're dealing with a criminal offence under the Electoral Act provisions, that is a SAPS matter. So there are codependencies in the mandate that interlocks with other agencies and with the constitutional architecture overall. So I often get the feeling that when these issues are being discussed, they're also being discussed in a way that assumes that the amendment to the Electoral Act or an amendment to the Electoral Commission Act will be the complete solution. That's not the case. It's not that simple. There are deeper codependencies. So if there's a deeper discussion, it taps into deeper codependencies and deeper elements of constitutional hierarchy and constitutional architecture. And I wanted to underscore that. It doesn't in any way diminish the core mandate of the IEC, but it does contextualize it for the conversation that is being envisaged by the Vice Chair with the political parties. And just to also caution that discourses on only the Electoral Act or only the Electoral Commission Act will not necessarily be resolving some of the deeper issues where there are codependencies that are historic. If you look at the constitutional negotiations, when the Independent Broadcasting Authority was initially set up with the initial Electoral Commission, there have always been codependencies. So I think it's something that requires a much more deeper look into where those codependencies exist, and for that to be part of the conversation.
And I think the chief electoral officer would probably want to deal with some of the questions. In relation to voter registration, we continuously try to find innovative ways of dealing with that particular issue. From time to time, when we're having registration process, there's a new innovation that we put in that's supposed to simplify the process, that's supposed to make this much more easy. And therefore, some of the issues that you have mentioned are things that we are looking into to see what we can do. But just to also indicate that to have registration, you require an infrastructure. So, for instance, you'd have to have a person having a map, having a registration form, and that map must be able to indicate the boundaries of where the particular person resides in order to make sure that you register a person at the right voting, in the right voting district. Now, if I use the example that you have used of a bank, when a person comes to the bank, that person might be coming from Soweto and you might be having only the maps for Sandton, because the bank is in Sandton. Now, the likelihood of registering that person illegally is very, very high. So, whatever innovations that we put in place, they've got to try to deal with situations where it is not going to be creating a confusion to the voter, and it's not also not going to contaminate our registration and our voters' roll. But we indeed look at all innovative ways of making sure that we can register as many people as possible. Sometimes we have targeted registration. We look at the statistics, we check in terms of the numbers, how many people are registered in a particular area. If the voting district has been cut into two, maybe as a result of demarcation processes, we go there again, introduce targeted registration, make sure that we capture as many people as possible. But continuously, process of registration is something that we need to continue to try to find innovative ways of improving. Now, the second aspect relates to the political parties and passing people to influence the results of an election, particularly the by-election. We have raised this issue with the political parties. The only thing that I think we can do at that level is to keep on appealing to people and not to do it. You know, in a manner that the legislation is captured when it comes to registration, it says a person must register where they are ordinarily resident. And the place of ordinary residence is defined as, in legislation, as a place to which a person returned to after a period of temporary absence. So, in other words, we accept the bona fides of a person when a person says, I reside in this particular area. If you decide that a university or a school or a voting district where your school is your place of residence, you can register in that particular area and say, this is my area of ordinary residence, because I come here from time to time. It does not say you've got to provide physical address. And then therefore, it is difficult from the side of the commission to be able to determine whether a person is indeed fraudulently registering or whether, in fact, this person does come here after a period of temporary residence. So those are some of the difficulties that we have in terms of that piece of legislation, because we're not required, as I suggested, to get evidence that a person indeed resides in a particular area. You know, so we keep on appealing to the political parties to help us as the Electoral Commission not to contaminate our voters' roll. We've got the best voters' roll that is very, very current in the whole world, and we want to keep it that way. And we want to request the military parties to cooperate with us to make sure that that doesn't happen. That is the contamination of our waters. And so I'm sure you want to respond to some of the issues.
If you can try and assist us within the next 10 minutes.
Yes.
So that we are able to take GPW. Thank you very much.
I thank you very much, Chairperson. The Vice Chairperson and Commissioner Taylor have dealt with quite a number of the issues. The questions raised by MEMNC, insufficient evidence in Program 2, relate to our annual report. On page 37, you will see strategic objective 2.1 on that page. 2.1.1 is the performance indicator that the AG found that there were challenges with evidence. The other one is on page 39, 2.4.3. In that area as well, the AG challenged the evidence that we had. That's why we now have the outreach management system, which will deal with that evidence and capture that evidence as will be required by the Auditor General. What is being done to address IT capacity? We are currently working on, we have previously worked on an outsourced model. We are looking at that situation to see whether a combination of both insourcing and outsourcing would be or complete insourcing. How did IC manage to revise 3 regulations in 1 year? We had a number of changes as per the bill, which has forced us to go and deal with those areas. But quite happily, when we looked at the primary legislation in every area, we also looked at the implications that it would have on regulations. So when we draft the one, we also look at the other. And by the time the one is approved, the other one is way on its way to being completed. The CRO and legal compliance position, Chairperson, you've asked the question. That situation is receiving attention as I speak to you. The Commission yesterday has approved that a number of measures be taken, including bringing a professional in this area for a period of 1 year. So we will be talking a different language when we come in the next year. Payment of electoral staff. Regrettably, all payments for electoral staff members, we are required, and as you would recall, when our financials were audited, were qualified in 2000, following the 2011 elections, it was because of this area of the work, where we need to be sure that the persons we pay are the persons that have worked in our area of work. And often, you recruit people in advance, train them, but on election day, they don't show up. And instead, someone that you have to go and improvise and pick from the street or be referred to go and pick elsewhere. You don't have the details of their payments and things. You capture those details later, and ordinarily, they will not be paid at the same time as the persons whose details you had. And those are some of the challenges that we've had. But we've also had changes in banking accounts, dormant accounts for a period of time that banks now close for a period of time, and you can't process payments. These are some of the challenges that we deal with. There may be one or two questions that we have missed out. Mr. Figland, I'm quite willing to talk to you after this. There was a question you raised. I could not see the reference that you were dealing with, but I'm quite happy to deal with you. Chairperson, I thank you very much.
You're okay. Okay. Honorable members, I think we will need to thank the IEC, and then to say that they must continue to do everything is in their power to ensure that the integrity is intact of the IEC. And of course, as well, request our are there in the legislation to ensure that certain things don't happen, then we utilize those tools and safeguard the integrity of the IEC and its processes. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. We greatly appreciate the opportunity to appear before you.
Thank you very much. And can we then just have a minute or a minute and a half and allow GPW then to find themselves on the front benches here so that we can speak to them? Thank you very much.
Most of it, and Sabana will present the annual financial
BMW, as honourable members know, is 127 years old, government printing works, and is currently undergoing a period of rapid transition in terms of printing technology and the work of state printers worldwide. Our legislative mandate is that we are a government component reporting to the Minister of Home Affairs, the Honourable Mr. Magusi Kikabe, MP. GPW was designated a government component on the 9th of October 2009 and listed in Schedule 3, Part A of the Public Service Act of 1994 as amended. At that time, National Treasury, DPSA, and Home Affairs felt that the government printing works was not quite ready to become a state-owned company, and that there should be a transition phase as a government component to ensure that the business was stabilized. The purpose of GPW is to deliver security printing and related services to the government of South Africa. In terms of our strategic outlook, we see ourselves evolving into a print and media company in tandem with other leading security printers, state printers around the world, such as Bundesdruckerei in Germany, the government printing office in the United States, and La Prémerie Nationale in France. And our vision now is to be the state's mandated security printer. We think we have completed the task of becoming a government component over the past 4 to 5 years, and we think we need to continue on the road to becoming a state-owned company over the next few years. Our mission is threefold: to provide cost-effective, reliable, and timely services in security printing to all spheres of government. Secondly, to provide the public with valuable information. And then thirdly, to disseminate government information through technology, innovation, and service excellence. As a security printer, our values are reliability, integrity, accuracy, and stakeholder satisfaction. We have three strategic outcome-oriented goals for the period 2013 to 2018. The first of these is state-owned company, to further develop the government component to become a state-owned company. Secondly, to optimize processes and facilities. To optimize processes and facilities to increase operational effectiveness and improve customer service. Thirdly, a diverse workforce. To have an efficient, effective, well-trained and developed workforce and a special remuneration dispensation for the government component. There are four branches in this company. The core branch is operations and production. We are a manufacturing outfit. We manufacture security products. Strategic management is critical, particularly in the sub-branches of information and communication technology, which is increasingly becoming part of our internal business processes, as well as the platforms in which we deliver information, government information, to the general public. Marketing and stakeholder relations is key, and of course security is vital in the security printer. The third branch is financial services. If we are to be a profitable, sustainable business, government-owned business, then financial services are key, and as well as the supply chain management that falls under financial services. And then fourthly, human resources. As we transform into a print and media company, embracing all the modern technologies that state printers currently use, our human resource must be developed, skilled, trained, and well remunerated for the task. In terms of our key projects, this is the progress that we made during the year under review. In terms of the e-Gazette, the ERP system, and the Lisaki Street site renovation. Firstly, upgrading of the electronic Gazette so that material can be submitted in electronic PDF files is well underway, and we should be able to launch within the next month or two. Upgrading of the enterprise resource planning system continues. Development of Affiliate 3 began in December 2013, and this will be converted into an examination center using high-speed digital printers and a dispatch center for dispatch passports, smart ID cards,
and examination papers, and should be completed by the end of 2015. The development of a master plan for the Sfaxi Street site began in December 2013. As the honourable members know, there have been a lot of delays in the renovation of the Sfaxi Street site, partly because of difficulties with another government department, but the process is underway, and we expect renovation of the entire site to be due for completion by the end of 2017. Our passport and ID card factory is a billion-rand facility that is the equal to any in the world, including in high-income countries. And this picture shows the renovation underway in what we call Pavilion 3, which will house the examination center with its high-speed digital printers at the back, and then in the front, the dispatch center for passports, smart ID cards, and examination papers. And in this cutaway, you can see how the renovation is being conducted, ensuring that we abide by regulations of South African heritage in order to ensure the facade is maintained. Other key projects during the period under review include finalizing the plans for the new refugee passport. The UNHCR has mandated, has instructed various countries around the world to update the refugee passport. And also plans are underway for a new e-passport sometime in the next year or two. Perhaps the flagship project, however, of the last few years has been the Smart ID Card project. This project was launched by the President on the 9th of August 2013, Women's Day, and production of Smart ID Cards began on the 15th of October 2013. By the beginning of this month, 700,000 Smart ID Cards had been produced, and the monthly production rate of Smart ID Cards for the first time overtook the rate of ID book production in June 2014. This month's Smart ID Card production rate is nearing 200,000 per month as 100 DHA offices come on stream with live capture. The department's target for this financial year is to produce 1.5 million Smart ID Cards, and we think that target is actually likely to be exceeded. This is a picture of one of the four Smart ID Card personalization machines that are installed at the Passport and Smart ID Card factory. Three of them are in that factory, and the fourth one is situated at the disaster recovery site 15 kilometers away in Pretoria. So that if there's a plane lands on the disaster street site, within hours, production of passports and Smart ID Cards can continue uninterrupted from the disaster recovery site. The Smart ID project plans that the 38 million ID books currently in circulation will be replaced with Smart ID cards over the next 7 years, i.e. completed by the end of 2021. That demands a production rate of 5.4 million cards per year, or approximately 450,000 cards per month. And we think within the next 12 months or so, we should be reaching that production rate. As I mentioned, the disaster recovery site is also currently fitted out and ready in case disaster should strike at the disaster street site. In terms of our production statistics, this slide compares the past 4 years, beginning on the right of the slide in 2010-2011, to the left of the slide 2013-2014. And you can see that the range production of passports has stabilized at around 650,000 per month. Since the new South African passport was introduced in 2009, there has not been a single successful forgery among the 4 million or so new passports that have been produced. In terms of identity books, in the past we produced about 2.2 million ID books per annum, but this is reducing now, and as I mentioned, in June, the rate of smart ID card production overtook that of ID books. The figure for smart ID cards, 134,000, is for the period up to March 31st, 2014, but currently as we speak, over 700,000 smart ID cards have been produced. finding that since the launch of the e-cassette, more and more of our subscribers are reverting to the use of the e-cassette rather than the printed government cassette. And for each subscriber, this means instead of producing over 110,000 A4 pages of paper throughout a year for subscribers to government cassette, they can instead access the electronic cassette and download and print the section of it that they want. On average, a subscriber only uses 2% of the government cassette. And obviously, this will mean great savings in terms of paper and forests. And as I mentioned earlier, the next month or so, to the government will be enabled. I need to ask Mr. Barnard, the CFO, to check the financials.
Thank you, CEO, honorable chair, honorable members. I will just go through a few highlights of the financials of GBW for the year under review. On this specific slide, you will notice that our turnover has dropped compared to the previous year. In the previous year, we were fortunate enough to have big projects, especially from the Department of Education, which didn't materialize under the year, in the year under review. Although the turnover has dropped, and that's also partly due to the smart card ID rollout that's been delayed, because we budgeted quite a substantial amount for the 2013-14 financial year. Besides all of those issues, we were still able to contain our expenses, and we're trying to keep it up to run to be as cost-effective and as efficient as possible. I think we can still make some further improvements, but you would have noticed that although the turnover has dropped, our gross profit has increased. We were able to achieve a gross profit percentage of close to 36% compared to the previous period of about 22%. And if one looks at the return on investment, we've had a very great year compared to previous years and what our targets were. Our targets, as far as return on investment, was about 28%, and we achieved 44%. As far as our cash position is concerned, maybe on the next page, as the members would know and the chair would know, that we don't get government funding. We are an entity that that needs to drive our own income to defray our own expenses. And under the year under review, although we made substantial investment in the ID card project, we were still able to grow our cash to about the tune of about 270 million. One area that we still need to work on, and it's an area that we constantly focus on and trying to improve on that, is the debt collection itself. We set ourselves a very ambitious target of 60 days because government departments are supposed to pay us within 30. We only achieved 77 days. It was an improvement of the previous year of 88 days. And it proves to be an area, especially when you find that it is national departments and we distribute all over the country, and the national departments need to wait for all the documentation to get from all the remote areas in order for them to make the final payment. So as far as our financial situation is concerned, it might seem like we've got 1.3 billion in the bank and it's quite a lot of cash. The further development of Sarkis Street, as well as the asset replacement program that we undertook 3 or 4 years ago, is basically going to take up all that cash. So it's very important that the GBW in the next couple of years maintain this profitability that it had achieved in the last couple of years in order to successfully transform the organization. Thank you, Chair.
Are we done?
In terms of transformation organization, we're not only transforming the business, but there's also been demographic transformation that's taking place. GP has transformed from an organization that in 1994 was 100% white and predominantly male to an organization now with a workforce of 555, of whom Peter's vision of becoming, say, a data security printer, though that would still need to be put into legislation. GPW is now ready to complete the transformation into a state-owned company over the next few years. Progress has been made in becoming a modern print and media company through ERP, to integrate financial and production information systems, and through delivering products such as the Government Gazette through the GPW website. A public website has been launched, including an electronic Government Gazette with submission of material by electronic PDFs and files, soon to go live. Rollout of smart ID cards began on the 15th of October 2013, and to date over 700,000 smart ID cards have been printed, and the rate of production is now nearing 200,000 cards per month, with live capture data from 100 DHA offices that are equipped with live capture. All ID books will replace the 38 million smart ID cards over the next 7 years, completion by the end of 2021. The business is expanding as more and more government departments bring the work to government printing works. Thank you for this opportunity to brief the Portfolio Committee on Home Affairs. Honourable Chair, if you wish me to address the performance information, I can do. May wish to field questions or whatever, but I think I hope the honourable members have received the slides on the key performance indicators, and I think that's fairly self-explanatory.
Yeah, I think I will need to be advised by the members, because that's actually the section that we're supposed to receive, and the section that we have received up to now, it also have elements of the APPs instead of annual performance, and I'm sure maybe moving forward we should be clinical to separate the APP section and the annual report section, because surely what is now following after you have finished is more or less what we are supposed to get together with some of the elements that are in this previous section, which relates to a report on the previous financial year, how you performed. So it's honorable members. The GPW indicates that whether we want to be taken through the next session. I'm sure all of us are having this nice document. I think we should appreciate this time around that now pages have been printed both sides, which is a major achievement. And then the information, which is a lot more critical now, it is this session that talks to performance. And I'm not sure whether you need him to take us through, but unfortunately, that's what we came here for. Yes. Should I then not ask a professor just to take us on the performance achievements on the next pages?
I can do that for you, Honourable Chairperson, very quickly. It's the second half of this document, and it's the annual performance report for 2013 to 2014. In which we succeeded achieving or exceeding the targets for 71 of 104 targets set amongst those key performance indicators. In many instances when a target was missed, the circumstances were beyond the control of GPW, as you will see as I go through. In terms of the core branch, production operations and production, the first KPI was completed construction of security facilities and relocation once new security facilities are completed. We did not achieve this target. However, renovation of Pavilion 3 has commenced. In terms of equipment, we did succeed in procuring three items of new equipment. In terms of the ID documents and cards conforming to client specifications, there was 100% conformity. In terms of turnaround time of ID documents, we only just missed the turnaround time of 11 to known losses to theft of the security products we produced. Unqualified audit opinion, we maintained an unqualified audit opinion for the fifth year running. We succeeded in reducing audit findings by 8.3%. We achieved a turnaround time of less than 10 days for financial management reports, 9 days on average. And we achieved our target of a turnaround time for performance reports of 30 days. In terms of revenue generated, we missed our target, as the CFO has pointed out. Our target was 1.2 million rand of revenue. We reached 780. 1.2 billion rand, rather. We reached a target of 780 million rand, so we just missed by a substantial amount our target. In terms of operating cost as a percentage of revenue, our target was 19.4%, but we missed that. Performance was 25.2%, and as the CFO has outlined, that's partly because our revenue was not as high as we had anticipated. However, gross profit margin was far in excess of target of 37.4% and was actually 35.9%, and the CFO has explained why that is. Debtor collection period, we missed our target of 60 days and only achieved 77 days. In terms of API procurement, our target was 20% of products and services procured from historically disadvantaged enterprises. We only achieved 80%, and part of that was because of the large amount of procurement of the smart ID brand cards and the personalization machines, which were from international suppliers who were not HDIs. Inventory turnover rate, we achieved our target of 2.5 times. In terms of supply chain management policy, we reached our target of having that revised and approved. We did not reach target of investment in additional production assets of 350 million rand. We achieved 41.65 million rand, and that partly related to the delays in the renovation of the Sachs Street site. We cannot put new machines in the old building, the new machines must go into newly renovated buildings. Return on capital investment was very high, far exceeding the target 27.9%, and was 44%. In terms of our human resources plan, we managed to implement the human resources plan. And also, with revised job descriptions and evaluations, 100% of those targeted were achieved. We did not succeed in implementing the migration plan, and that's partly related to the delays in renovation of the historic street site. We did not reach our target of filling posts in the SMS grade 5 to fill posts in accordance with the staffing plan, but our target was to fill 14 of those SMS posts. Again, we missed our target in terms of implementing the GPW training academy. We did, however, reach our target of attaining 3 training days per employee. In terms of our special remuneration dispensation, we managed to complete the submissions for that, but the special remuneration dispensation has still not been approved by DPSA. We managed to approve and implement our human resource policies, all 6 of the outstanding ones. In terms of ECOVET, we implemented, reviewed and refined the ECOVET system as we targeted. We reviewed and refined the public web project. We did not manage to establish and implement a call center. In terms of branding and implementation branding and the logo, that has been achieved. 100% of government gazettes were published according to quality and delivery specifications. We developed the brand and logo as I mentioned before. In terms of product diversification, target was 1 new product to be developed. We developed 4 new products. The marketing strategy was completed and approved. In terms of ICT, system availability was in excess of 98%. payments was more than 90%, it was 95%. Sending ICT staff attending ICT service management training, we reached our targets of 99%. 100% of initiatives in ICT services have been successfully implemented. We managed to implement business continuity in terms of the ICT environment. In terms of internal audits, percentage of risk-based internal audits to plan, we actually missed that target. There's a typo there. We only managed to implement 73% of the internal audits for the year. And in terms of security risk management, we implemented the security risk management plan. We did not implement that plan, sorry. And those are the 50 key performance indicators, and those that we those targets we achieved and those that we missed.
Thank you very much, honourable members. I think now we have heard the whole presentation. We may be tired, but we are still at work. And then can we engage GPWP? Honorable Kenya, Honorable Fichlen, Nisi, but you are still on. And then there is saying, and then Gumede will possibly close. Thank you very much. In that order, Honorable Kenya.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the presentation, which is clearly, marked, and also the font is up to date, up to standard. My first question is on the issue of page 26. You talk about the target which is missed, and you said that it is because circumstances were beyond your control. Now, I don't know, why don't you say, you explain to us the challenges, to unhappy challenges, so that you don't just say to us the circumstances were beyond control. Secondly, on the page 29 on finances, yes, you commend your fit and qualified on your support, especially with no matters of emphasis. But you must try for clean audit. To avoid irreversal, because it's also easy to reverse the good work that you have done. And also the reason not getting the clean audit is due to compliance with laws relating to internal audit. How are you addressing that issue? And then on your conclusion, you talk about progress made in becoming a modern print and media company. What is your state of readiness? Will this affect your present organogram, which is not also unpacked on your human resource? And also, what is your vacancy rate? Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Honorable Fischler.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I don't know if there is a fraudulent or what have you, somebody is trying to set me up. So I'm married already. I don't know who this is. Maybe this was displayed by mistake. And I think it's a different ID. Why do you think it's okay? Chairperson is just to find out why is financial information in the report indicated according to annual year rather than financial year. That's the first question. The second one, the report of the performance against strategy objective is not clearly distinguished from reporting against performance indicators, creating confusion on the amount of targets achieved.
situation. I would also like to commend the GPW for receiving its fifth conservative unqualified audit opinion for the year 2013-14 annual report. We are looking forward as a committee for the GPW to get a clean audit report. My first question, Chair, is regarding the internal audit. I would like to know how has the GPW addressed the concerns relating to compliance relating to internal audit, because their annual target was 100% and reformed is only 72%. If I may get clarity on that. My second question, Chair, the GPW has managed to achieve only 37 targets, that is 68% in an improvement from 61% achieved in 2012-13, and 2013-14 is 71%, 71 out of 104. The question is, what is being done to improve on the rate of achieved targets set by the GPW? My other question is on page 32. On the branch human resources. Under point 25, GPW Training Academy. What might be the reason for the GPW to fail to implement one of its key performance indicators of training academy? If I can be clarified on that one. Thank you very much, Chair.
Yes, I think the opportunity is now for Honorable Hussein, who's not going to say his comment.
I have one interesting question. Maybe two. The longer I stay, I will get more. Chair, the only question I have is you said you're printing on 200,000 smart ID cards a month, and if you do the math there, but if you're going to do 38 million at 200,000 a month, you're only going to finish this thing in about 15 years. But the department said it's on the tablet for like 7 years. So I'm interested to hear how you're going to be able to meet the target the department has set. I'm not sure whether you're aware that that's the target that they set to hold it out in that space of time. The transition to a state-owned enterprise, I heard that comment in the beginning, and I'm just interested to hear, is that still on the books? Is that something that's coming down the line? So I hate to see if you break something that's fixed. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, and of course, Honorable Gumede said he has got nothing. I'm sure he may have generated something that needs to be checked. Honorable Gumede.
No, I don't really accept to if I could get the clarification of what they mean by a state-owned distinct company. Are they going to rely on the on their marketing only, revenue only? Or are they still going to operate like a company that still needs money from the government, or perhaps they are going to operate like SARS or the Auditor General? I don't know. I just wanted to get an explanation.
Okay. From my side, I think on the target of investment, I think it's on page 31. I really do have a bit of a problem. I understand your predicament, and then documents. But probably if we could just get them to sharpen up so that when they actually indicate numbers, they must be informed about the possibility of being achieved in specific times. And then the second one is a special dispensation. You have recorded that you have achieved that one. Are you saying that it is now being implemented? Because if it is achieved, then it must be readily available for implementation. And if it is not readily available for implementation, then the question that it is achieved, then it becomes problematic. Maybe if you could just talk, also talk to that after all other questions. Thanks. Continue.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members, for these questions. Challenges, the Honorable Member mentioned. I would say that the principal challenges that we face are, first of all, the renovation of Isakhi Street, which began in 2009, and 5 years later is not even halfway through. And the problem there has been the disarray within the Department of Public Works. It has improved more recently in that after a delay of 4 or 5 years, they did actually appoint a development team who are currently developing the site master plan. And so we hope that the renovation will continue, will go to ground early next year and be completed by the end of 2017. The other major challenge that we face is in terms of the special salary dispensation. In the key performance indicators, what we mentioned was that we achieved the target of preparing the submissions for the special salary dispensation, submissions that the previous Minister of Public Service Administration had requested her task team, composed of her own senior officials and GPW officials. She requested that she prepare a submission that was prepared. It was put on the desk about a month before the national elections, and nothing happened after that. Our current minister, Minister Gigaba, has taken up the matter and is scheduling a meeting with Minister Chabane to discuss the special salary dispensation. The portfolio committee recommended the special salary dispensation about 3 years ago, but it still has not been implemented. In terms of the unqualified audit, the Honourable Member is absolutely correct. Our ambition now should be to achieve a clean audit. The only thing that prevented us achieving a clean audit this year, according to the Auditor General, was the fact that internal audit only completed 73% of its work. There are various reasons for that, which we are addressing, and one of those is capacity. And so we've recruited an extra audit specialist, so there are now two, plus the chief audit executive. And we're just about to appoint a few more junior auditors as well as audit interns to ensure that this financial year 100% of the work is completed. And so we hope that if we achieve 100% of the audit plan this year and there are no other problems, that we may perhaps achieve a clean audit next year. The Honourable Member is very perceptive. This transition to becoming a printed media company is in a sense inevitable. It is what all state printers in advanced countries around the world are doing, but it comes with its own problems and has profound impact on the organogram. In the past, when we were an ink and paper company, we had artisans who got ink on their fingers. And increasingly in the future, we will have highly skilled artisans who download the job from a memory stick and who manage computer consoles and never touch ink. So the printing industry is dramatically different to what it was before. And of course, increasingly state printers now deliver information through the internet and through ICT, rather than through printed sheets of paper. So that's a headache for us because our so-called establishment is 700, but we anticipate that we are not likely to have 700. able to implement the organic growth completely, we anticipate that the organization will be very different. And that is one of the reasons why the special site dispensation is so important, because the high-skilled artisans that we will employ in the future come at a price. They are easily poached by other companies who are also going through such technology revolutions. And we need to deal with it with a matter of how we might anticipate these changes. So a good example would be in ID book production. We employed about 30 people in ID book production who are mainly lower-skilled people. Now with the smart ID card coming on board, and we anticipate within the next 12 months the instructors to stop printing ID books, those 30 staff will have to be redeployed within the organization, because the 3 smart ID card machines only require about 8 highly skilled staff to operate them, not 30 low-skilled staff. So very different. Our vacancy rate is approximately 22% at the moment. It has improved since the previous year, but the vacancy rate is mainly a problem within the SMS grades. We reduced our SMS staff from 32 down to 25 in the organogram, but even with 25 SMS positions, only half of them are filled. And there are various reasons for that, partly the challenge of finding the appropriate staff, but also the challenge of ensuring that in our recruitment we continue to employ to obey employment equity law. And as you can imagine, in terms of getting highly skilled technical or professional staff who are black and female, etc., often involves paying a premium within the market. So again, not having a specialized dispensation makes it difficult for us to fill the SMS position and to ensure we do it within the parameters of employment equity law. I'll ask the CFO to address Honorable Fiedler's questions about the financial information and about the lack of clarity about performance versus strategic objectives as opposed to key performance indicators.
Thanks, Chair and Honorable Members. Maybe I should just start by just asking clarification on the member who asked on the financial statements, why we talk about an annual financial year. I don't fully understand the question.
You may clarify. 41 on 2014-2013 on the annual report. It's page 21. 41, sorry.
You got the page? Okay. Jefferson, all my members, GPW, because it's an entity that is not funded by the fiscus, so we don't get any allocation during the year, we report according to international standards. For the year that just passed, the 13-14 year, we still complied with South African GAAP, and those headings that we use is standard. It's not like we've got a choice as to what words we use. It's a standard heading that is prescribed. I can't change those headings. There's fixed, our South African GAAP has actually fallen away by the end of the December 2013 year. But our South African GAAP was 100% in line with international reporting standards, and that's the way we're going to report in future, and if we should become that SOC. As far as the specific targets are concerned, obviously when we encounter problems with the specific facilities, the facilities has got a compound effect that it affects other targets as well, because we couldn't. In 2008, we wrote a business case, and in that business case, we developed what we call asset replacement program. So in the Versailles facility, all the production equipment that's going to go in there is going to be part of that program, and so it's going to be new equipment. None of the old equipment from the Boston City facility will be moved to Versailles. So if the facility is not developed, it would mean that we could go and procure the equipment But in reality, that equipment will basically stand in threat because we've got no facility whatsoever to unpack that and get the machines operational. And that's why we're missing some of the targets. And it's the same, what the CEO has alluded to, the same as far as the targets are concerned. I think as far as the organogram is concerned, we try to keep it as new as possible, taking into account the changes that we need to go through. So there's certain areas that it's very difficult to fill because you'll fill the position, but there will be no work for that person because, like you alluded to, we need those highly skilled people to go and do certain things. I think as far as the, maybe I can address the question about the investment. In the last financial year, that was also part of the asset replacement program. We had that target, and that target was set up of certain pieces of equipment, and that equated to a certain rand value. With the ID card issue coming on board as well, besides the issue with the facilities, we had to concentrate on the machines and equipment that we need to get this project going. And that's why that investment in the assets didn't take place as originally planned. And those were the two main reasons. The one was the ID card project, and the other one was the readiness of the facilities. I think as far as profitability is concerned, if one goes back in history and look at where GBW was in 2008-9, maybe as a starting point when the business case was written, is that you would have noticed that in the years preceding that, at least 10 years, there was very low profitability and there were basically no cash. And over the period, I think GBW over the last 5 years has proven that it can be a successful organization if it's managed properly. And I think if one just looks at the cash that we've got on hand at the end of the year, if there was a plan for Treasury to have an allocation even I think up to 2016-17. And 2 years ago, we agreed with Treasury that is no longer needed because GPW is a self-funding organization and can look after itself. So I wouldn't like to be compared with other organizations that on a regular basis look for government bailouts. I don't think that would be totally fair. I think we've got the track record now over the last 5 years, and I think that was one of the obstacles that we didn't become an SOC in 2009. That we had to prove to have this track record first before we could embark on this road. I think as far as the readiness is concerned, we already got the draft state printer's bill, what we call the draft state printer's bill, and it's now in the hands of, and we need to go through that process to see if, and everybody agrees. I think that previously everybody agreed that GPW is now in a state of readiness and it should convert to that SOC. Because like the CEO has alluded to, the Saudi dispensation is really a sore point. It was spoken about in the business case of 2008 already. And there are certain skills that we require because we compete with the manufacturing sector and the private sector. And there are certain skills that we require that we are not competitive. I can tell you of certain posts that we've not been able to fill in the last 6 years. And every year we go 2 to 3 rounds of the same interviews for the same position and we're still not able because we are way below what the market is offering. And that will go especially if we've got the specialized equipment and we need the specialized skills in the production environment. Thank you, Chair.
Please still continue.
In terms of contract workers that Honourable Figler mentioned, over the years we've tried to depend less and less on contract workers as such, and increasingly our workforce is becoming more highly skilled and technologically competent, and so our challenge then is firstly to recruit such workers and to retain them in permanent positions and ensure that they're appropriately remunerated. Honourable Nisi mentioned about the internal audit only achieving 73% of its work plan. How are we addressing it? Well, we're fully capacitating internal audit to ensure that it has all the necessary staff with the necessary skills to make sure they complete their work plan. In terms of moving from 61% target achieved to 68% this year and to try and get above 70 and 80%, the way we do that is we sit with the Auditor General as an executive in order to develop a combined matrix, that is a matrix that looks at And we also look at the various stumbling blocks to achieving all our targets, such as delays in the renovation of Israeli Street, consequently delays in asset recapitalization, delays in implementing the new organogram, etc. The main reason why the Shedding Academy was not implemented in this year under review was because we had managed to recruit a general manager for human resources, but within months she left for a higher paid job, and that was what has stymied the implementation of this important initiative. Nevertheless, you know, I myself have visited various academies around the country to gain an understanding of what such an academy might look like. For instance, the academy that Power Media have in Paul, which is a training academy, this will be critical as we undergo the technological change that is inevitable. The Honourable Hussein mentioned about reaching 200,000 cars a month in October means we'll fall far short of our target. The main rate limiting step in terms of the monthly production of ID cards has not been the personalization machines. The personalization machines on an 8-hour daily shift, producing 3,000 cards an hour, can produce 5 million cards a year on one 8-hour shift. Now, we estimate that if Home Affairs is to reach its target of issuing 38 million smart ID cards by the end of 2021, they will have to produce 5 million cars a year. So just on one 8-hour shift, we can manage that target. We could do double that if we have two 8-hour shifts. I think the CFO has alluded to the timetable as to when we hope to become a state-owned enterprise. The draft bill is in the minister's office, and I'm sure that he will be discussing it with the portfolio committee as to what progress might be made then. So the Honourable Chairperson mentioned about the equipment and facilities and again achieving targets. I think we are making progress. I think Honourable Minister Messi has made great strides in terms of beginning to turn around the Department of Public Works. And so after years of stagnation, we are managing to actually move ahead in terms of getting these facilities renovated so that we can put the new machines in the facilities, and so that newly trained and upskilled technical workers can occupy those facilities and run those machines. In terms of the special site dispensation, the KPI we put there was for the submission having been completed, but the actual dispensation is not yet in place. And we mentioned the reasons for that the submission did land on the Minister of Public Service Administration desk just before the national election, but our minister now has asked Minister Chabane if they can meet and discuss that submission and see what can be done about a special site dispensation for GBW. Thank you, Honourable Chair.
Yeah, Honourable Gulede.
Thank you. I just wanted to thank you very much, Chairperson. No, in fact, the distinction I wanted to make was around the printing works having funds for running itself when it had a shortfall. And now, if you have a surplus now, are you going to pay that surplus to the National Revenue Fund like any other state company, or you are going to recapitalize with that and use it for your company? That was the distinction I wanted to point out. Thanks.
Yeah, they want to stand on their own feet. Let them explain.
Thank you, Chair. The rules indicate that that's what we should do, and every year we apply because of the transformation that we're going through, and National Fisheries is fully aware of all the plans that we've got in terms of the facility in Sasaka Street is going to cost us roughly about 1 billion rand to finalize the refurbishment. The asset replacement program is going to take up for the assets that we are aware of and correct. Otherwise, if they don't give their permission, then we should pay it over. But this far, because of the expansion plans and everything that we want to do, they let us keep those surpluses.
Okay. Honourable members, are we done? Well, what the point I was raising about the investments, it is just simply to say that you need to base your plans on information that is reasonably correct. Because if you don't do that, you may find yourself locking a lot of financial resources in a piece of equipment that you can't use because you have not applied to connect to ESCOM. And you are not informed that you need to apply to ESCOM. Then you lock money into the equipment. When you come and I want to use it, ESCOM says no, we don't have power for you. So all, that's why I'm saying is we just need to get some of those people that are involved in planning to really dig deep and provide you with information that is workable, not to actually expect 350 something of investment or whatever that has to be done, but you just only achieve 70% or 50% because something is not workable. With you, with a little bit of deeper research, you could have got the information to say this public works is not capable of delivering this on this specific time. And then you tie up correctly when to get what, when what is ready. Thank you, GPW and honorable members. I think we had enough. And then also we must thank GPW again for having managed to grace this meeting and having stayed since morning in there. And of course is that they are better than many of us because now they know what happens in with the AG, with the Department of Home Affairs, with IEC, and then the other ones know nothing about GPW. So now thank you very much, and we appreciate for having honored our request. And honorable members, I think that takes us to the end of this session, and this session is adjourned.
Sorry, Chair. Can I just say, on this USB stick, there's two files. The one is the normal GPW annual report, and then there's a different format. You'll see there's a different file. If you open it up, it's called the e-book. So it will page over as and when required, or you can set it like photos when you view it. It will page over itself.
I just hope that when I connect it to my laptop, it's not going to download all my files to you.